Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFIL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.
Good morning, Valley Forge, King of Prussia, Greater Philadelphia, and everybody out there in Internet land. Welcome to We the People, the Constitution Matters. I'm your host, Gary Porter, Executive Director of the Constitution Leadership Initiative, and you can find out more about CLI at www.constitutionleadership.org. We have our regular team here this morning, Pastor David Whitney, Senior Instructor at the Institute on the Constitution, Phil Duffy, instructor of the Constitution at the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute, located at Widener University. We are examining, in this series, America's fundamental principles, the principles that have been responsible for 200 years of almost unbroken economic growth and prosperity. So far, we've looked at the principle of self-government, the principle of equality under the law, the principle of unalienable rights, and today we take up the principle that the power of government is derived from the people through their consent. The idea for this discussion comes, of course, from Thomas Jefferson's famous phrase in the Declaration of Independence that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. There's quite a lot in that simple sentence, I know. It speaks of rights and government and power and consent. Quite a bit to digest. I'm going to begin by asking Pastor David Whitney to step up to the plate and analyze the first part of that phrase for us. What are the just powers that Jefferson was talking about? How do they differ from what we might call arbitrary powers? And then I'll ask Constitution Instructor Phil Duffy to clarify what the second part of the phrase is all about. What is consent of the government? We know right up front that government that consent can be either overt, that is, expressed through some positive act, or it can be tacit, consent derived from our inaction, our silence, or our acquiescence. What Englishman Edmund Burke would have called salutary neglect. Does it make a difference how we, the people, express our consent? As normal, we'll be taking your calls in the second half of the show. So if any of our commentators say anything that you want to challenge or would like clarified, please give us a call. Write these numbers down. 610-539-TALK, that's 610-539-8255, or 610-539-1783, or 1784. Now, I'm told that Pastor David hasn't signed in yet this morning or logged in this morning, so we're going to go instead to Phil Duffy and ask Phil to comment on that second part of the phrase, what is the consent of the people? What's the big deal about this consent? Can't we just go about our business and let our representatives in Washington take care of things for us? Phil, what
Gary,
do you say?
Gary, I believe you've actually given me two questions to field this morning. The first is, shouldn't we just let our representatives in government take care of things for us? And your earlier question, the second one is, does it make a difference how we the people express our consent? And I'll try to respond to both of these questions in that order. Shouldn't we just let our representatives in government take care of things for us? Of course, that was the way government was handled throughout most of written history, with some notable exceptions such as Moses being directed to set up representative government during the Exodus. Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, Benjamin Franklin, Robert Livingston, and Roger Sherman cooperated to draft the Declaration of Independence, changing that historical tradition. Since then, school children have been taught to believe that representative government, that is, government based upon the consent of the governed, is an unqualified virtue, and I'm not so sure it's that simple. We've noted in earlier programs that the delivery of education has changed fundamentally over the period from the Declaration of Independence until today, and that state and federal governments have become increasingly stronger players while local control over education is diminished. So-called Common Core standards threaten to effectively change our educational system to a top-down directed and politically motivated system. This trend began in the mid-19th century and picked up speed in the progressive movement when a system of Prussian education was transplanted into the United States. The essence of the progressive movement is the establishment of the administrative state, governance by a bureaucracy of so-called experts who just so happen to be politically connected. For an administrative state to survive, it must maintain myth. This is just a variation on the bread and circuses theme. Keep the masses amused and distracted while a ruling class goes about the business of dictating its will to us, the unwashed. Let me demonstrate how that myth works with the concept of consent of the governed. What have our government-run schools taught us concerning the reason for our break with Great Britain? Taxation without representation is what we get out of the bland textbooks. How much were the colonists being taxed? I have seen it was something like 3% of income. Today, we allow ourselves to be taxed to the extent of approximately 50% of our income. But that's okay, because now we choose our own representatives. This is one of the convenient myths that allow the absurdity of the administrative state to continue unchallenged. How representative is our federal government today by comparison with a government that was formed in 1789 under our current Constitution? Let's start with the principle of representation built into the original Constitution, the idea that a member of the House of Representatives must represent no fewer than 30,000 people. Today, Congress has capped the number of representatives at 435 as a result of the Apportionment Act of 1911. With a current population of 322 million people in the United States, that translates into one representative for every 740,000 people. Can you imagine going into a grocery store to buy a product that has been adulterated by 25 times? Would you go back to that store? Yet we continue to believe that we are being represented the way our forefathers were. Practically, our system of representation has been adulterated by a factor of 25. That is what people who are running the administrative state expect us to do, continue to buy an adulterated product. Maintaining the myth of representative government is essentially to the ruling elite remaining in control of the rest of us. Ironically, they have even used guilt to keep us in place. We are told that bad government is caused by our not voting, and that when 45% of eligible voters in presidential elections don't vote, it is they, the 45%, who cause bad government. Note how easily those who actually bring us bad government, public officials, political parties, and influence lobbies, are excused. Political reality is that in federal elections, one's vote has as much chance of affecting an outcome as one has of being struck by lightning. Gary, you encourage listeners to call in, and I suspect that I have just caused the board at WFYL to light up. That telephone number is 610-539-8255, 610-539-1783, and 610-539-1784 if you wish to throw tomatoes at me.
No, they won't.
Now that I have everybody's attention, let me clarify my point. Of course we should vote, and particularly if we are knowledgeable about the issues. But consent of the government as a concept goes well beyond casting a vote annually, biannually, or even every 4 years. That kind of consent doesn't matter that much to politicians, since they have found ways to influence your vote and ways to ignore it once they are in office. John Philip Curran gave a speech in Dublin in 1790 in which he said, "The condition upon which God hath given liberty to man is eternal vigilance." Now, if that sounds like something that Jefferson was supposed to have said, consider the role that myth plays in our history. There is no evidence that Jefferson said that. Consent of the governed is a part-time job for a citizen, a responsibility that is always with you around the clock. Get used to it if you wish to be free. For those who accept this responsibility, there will be plenty of meetings with those who share your desire for freedom, demonstrations, educational sessions, and similar activities. Consent of the governed requires significant effort. But just making consent of the governed a part of your daily life is not realistic. It's foolish to dedicate one's life to a cause doomed to failure. There has to be hope, and that hope cannot be built upon a sense of responsibility alone. The good news is that we have the ultimate weapon in this battle, the Constitution. While an increasing population dilutes the influence we have over our public officials, the Constitution, once it is understood, limits the damage our federal officials can inflict on us. Once we understand our Constitution, we understand that it describes a government with limited enumerated powers. If you are a parent, think of it this way. Are you going to allow your children to set the rules in your household? The federal government is a child of the states and the people. Allowing it to have its way is an invitation to disaster. Parents understand that, in spite of many confrontations with their children, they will need to maintain control. The alternative is chaos and the children tyrannizing the parents. Let me return to the second question. Does it make a difference how we, the people, express our consent? You pointed out, Gary, that consent can be overt, expressed through some positive act, or it can be tacit. Consent derived from our inaction, our silence, or our acquiescence. A constitution is a social compact, a contract among parties that describes basic human action under the law and the services the people might reasonably expect from their government. My son constantly brings to my attention the fact that he never signed the Constitution of the United States. Is he a part of the consent of the government? I suppose that if we could count all the contracts that govern our actions, we would find that the written ones are the minority and the unwritten ones predominate. For example, go to a sports or entertainment event and you will be issued a ticket. The ticket may or may not have some limited terms printed on the back. Try acting in a way that is contrary to the custom for that event. You'll probably be ejected. Lots of luck trying to convince a jury of your peers that the ejection harmed you. You are considered to be a party to a lot of agreements that are unwritten. What matters in the law is that there is something called a meeting of the minds. Your participation in the event will be considered evidence that you agreed to behave yourself in exchange for the entertainment. Your participation in this nation is evidence that you accept the responsibilities of that participation. So to answer your question then, Gary, the Constitution establishes a contract between the people and government. A reasonable effort was made originally with the amendments and with the amendments through the ratification process to actively engage the people in the agreement. However, if you continue to enjoy the rights of citizenship under the protection of government, you are a party to the agreement. If you execute your responsibility faithfully under this agreement, you will acknowledge that the idea of the consent of the governed is more than periodically voting. You have accepted a part-time job.
Well, thank you, Phil, and a part-time job it is, but some of us, like you and I and Pastor David, know that it's, for some of us it's more than a part-time job. It's almost a full-time job keeping up with this and educating the public. Well, I think we have got Pastor David Whitney on the line now, so I'm going to turn to him and ask him, what is this deal about just powers that Jefferson was referring to in the Declaration of Independence, and how do we know when a power being exercised by government is, in fact, just? David?
Oh, thank you so much, Gary. Yes, a vitally important question, because there's various theories, if you you look across the globe, various theories about what justice is composed of. For example, Karl Marx believed justice is you don't own any property. The government owns everything, and it doles out to you whatever it deems, you know, you're fit for, however it deems that. Basically, government makes all those decisions, and you have no say about it. You own no property. And you can contrast that with other theories of government. So the question is, where do those just powers come from? Jefferson was very clear that those just powers come from the laws of nature and nature's God. And as we've said, I believe repeatedly, but just in case of someone wasn't with us on the radio show, that phrase, laws of nature and nature's God, refers to human conscience, human reason, and the Bible. Clearly, the Bible is the standard. It is the foundation of what is the laws of nature and nature's God. And it's the basis upon which they constructed our constitutional republic. I think today we're seeing an interesting illustration, although it's a tragic illustration in many ways now, of the difference between one belief system and Christianity as a belief system, as a foundation for law. After all, ISIS and the other, those who are devoted to Islam, if they truly follow what the Quran exhorts them to do, it's to wage continual jihad against anyone who is an infidel, which an infidel is defined as anybody that's not a Muslim, not following that religious belief system, or anybody that's not even a faithful Muslim. They also interpret it that way, that they can commit jihad against them. So, well, is that just? According to their theory, it is just, because they're obedient to the God they worship, Allah, to wage jihad against anyone who is not part of their belief system. And so if you're going to have a system of government that doesn't have a fixed foundation, which is what we're kind of being told today, it's whatever the majority of people determine is just. So, you know, if 51% of the people say owning property, owning real land is not possible, we're going to give all land to the government, if 51% of the people go to the polls and vote that that is the case, then that's what is just. I think most people have an inner sense that is identified by Jefferson as the laws of nature. That is, our conscience says, wait a minute. I know when someone steals from me. I know when I exchange my labor for something that is my property, whether it's real estate or some other even movable piece of property, my automobile, I've exchanged my labor for that. I own it. I have property rights. And where do those property rights come from? Most of us, I think, don't take time to think about the origin of those property rights. But Jefferson and our founders clearly did think that through, and they said it clearly traces back to the Creator, the one who created the universe. In a sense, he owns all the property in the universe. So if we're talking about property rights, he's the one that gets to determine how those property rights are given and to whom they are given, to whom they are entrusted, which, by the way, if you know, go back to the Garden of Eden in Genesis 1, we find that God gave property rights to Adam and Eve, to the first family. You know, he told them to take dominion over the animals. So they had property rights in the animals that were theirs. They were their responsibility as stewards. Property rights in the Garden of Eden, it was theirs to tend and to steward. And so those property rights, our founders understood, really are rooted in the creation and the Creator's design and the Creator's law that he established at the beginning of time. And so if you're going to have a just society, you need to ask the question, what are the Creator's laws? What is the Creator's design for our society? And what's the Creator's design for us in our life together as human beings? So when our founders talked about property rights, they didn't look to a theory that would be like that of Karl Marx that said the government owns it all and you don't own anything. Well, they looked to God's Word. It clearly says family government is the primary steward to whom God has entrusted property rights, and therefore you have a right to own real property, physical property. You have a right to own movable property, you know, your chattel, the items that are in your household, and so on. And these rights are just, and it's the job of government to protect those God-given rights, to see that those rights, if they are violated, somebody breaks into your house and, you know, they steal your, whatever it is, they steal your TV, you have a process by which you can be, justice can be done. And by the way, God's word clearly spells out if it's theft, what that justice looks like is the thief is required to make full restitution to you, the one he stole from. And then certain classes of property, it's a fine, and the penalty is not paid to the government. It's actually paid to you, the person who had your property rights violated. And I think that's an interesting illustration today of how far we have strayed from the founder's vision. I think of a time in college where I was very poor, so getting around on a bicycle was the most frequent form of transportation. I had a car, but didn't use it much, and so the battery died. And so I went to replace the battery. In my day, that's a pretty expensive item there as a college student to buy a new battery, put the new battery in, everything worked fine. Well, come out the next day to use the car, put the key in, open the door, and the light doesn't come on. I say, that's odd. Put the key in the ignition, turn it, nothing. Not even a click, 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 nothing. What? Get out and look, and somebody stole my brand new battery. Well, you know, I understand the system that, okay, I'm going to go report this to the police. The police will have me write this full report and take all this information, and ultimately nothing happens. Nobody's caught. But what if that thief were caught who stole my battery? What would happen is that thief would pay a penalty. Now, let's suppose the thief stole the battery not in order to use it, but to sell it on the market, at a discount price so he could sell it quickly. He fences the battery. He gets money in his hand. And the police catch him, and the government fines him for stealing my property. Well, what happens to that money? Let's see, that money has gone from my pocket to the store to buy the battery. The battery then is stolen by this guy. He fences it, takes the money, and then the government catches him, and the government has him pay a fine to the government. And what happens to me, the injured party? I get nothing, absolutely nothing. I just get the hassle of having to go fill out this paperwork and all this mess, and I get nothing if they actually catch the thief, but the government actually takes my money in the end. If you draw the line from one to another, the government is the one that gets my money for the property that was stolen from me, and I get nothing. Well, God's word says that's not justice at all. Justice is when the government exists, and their process is to force the person who stole from you to make you whole. That is, to restore you to the position you were in before your property was stolen from you. And that's just one illustration of when we look at God's word, we find great wisdom in the justice system established in God's word. And I would contend that the reason why we are in such a mess today in America is we have departed from that justice system. And the issue I just illustrated there of thievery is but one example of a multitude. In fact, so grand is the scheme of injustice that the things like the Department of Justice are completely misnamed now. It should be the Department of Injustice, because they don't do justice almost anywhere. In fact, it seems like they do the opposite with most every action they take. So we have lost the understanding of our founders. And to recover that, tragically, what's happened in our land is the pulpits of America have grown silent about what the Word of God says on the issue of justice. And again, this is the vast difference between our founders' era and our day. The preachers of the colonial era leading up to the War for Independence preached on these subjects, preached about what justice looked like, preached about what just government looked like. And those sermons, actually, I forget who it is, you might remember, Carrie, that did the study of the Declaration of Independence and traced every significant idea in the Declaration of Independence to sermons that had been preached in the previous 50 years in the colonies. And the sermons preached in those days were often republished, often published in the newspapers of that week, and often, if they were particularly cogent, they were then republished in pamphlets and distributed all over the colonies. And those sermons laid the foundation and the groundwork, because the colonists understood what justice is, where justice comes from, and the standard was God's holy word.
Well, that's a great rundown, and you're right. We still have a foundation, but we've got to restore it. So we're going to be right back after these commercial messages to continue our discussion. Don't go away.
Working for your liberty right here in Philadelphia. Broadcasting freedom, shining light throughout the tri-state area. Streaming freedom, shining light from Philly to the nations. 1180 shining forth, we are the Freedom Station. WFYN.
Fox News Radio, I'm Joe Chiro. Congress faces a midnight deadline for government funding to run out.
Negotiators here are still hammering out a compromise for a $1 trillion spending bill funding government through most of next year. House Speaker Paul Ryan is giving more time for that, setting up a 5-day extension for government funding. The Senate passed it Thursday.
Fox's Jared Halpern. Lawmakers have been unable to resolve dozens of issues. Canada's prime minister welcoming a large group of Syrian refugees arriving on a government plane overnight.
They step off the plane as refugees, but they walk out of this terminal as permanent residents of Canada.
Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, he's pushing his campaign pledge to resettle 25,000 Syrian refugees in Canada by the end of February. The U.S. plans to resettle 10,000. Fox News, we report, you decide.
WFYL, King of Prussia, Philadelphia. Good morning. AM 1180 WFYL now begins its broadcast day. WFYL is owned and operated by Trinity Associates Broadcasting, LLC. WFYL operates on an assigned carrier frequency of 1180 kHz, as authorized by the Federal Communications Commission. Streaming live online at 1180WFYL.com. If you have any questions or comments about our programming, call 610-539-1783.
God bless America. My home, sweet home.
Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFYL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.
Welcome back to We the People, the Constitution Matters. If you're just joining us, we are examining Jefferson's idea that he laid out in the Declaration of Independence that the power that our government employs at all levels, whether federal, state, or local, is derived from the consent of the people. And we've heard from Pastor David Whitney and Phil Duffy on different aspects of that statement. In a few minutes, we'll take your phone calls on 610-539-8255, 610-539-1783, or 1784. So get your questions and comments ready. I want to begin my remarks by building on a couple of things that Phil said in his segment. Phil said the Constitution describes a central government of limited and enumerated powers. The framers thought that this was what they were setting up in 1787. That they thought that is indisputable. We have founders' quotes galore backing that statement up. In fact, if they had not thought that, if they had actually suggested that they were designing a government that, as former Congressman Peter Stark of California famously said, can do most anything in this country, then those founders would have been laughed out of the ratifying conventions if they were lucky. They would have been tarred and feathered if they were not.
But that's definitely what we have today, a federal government that can do most anything it wants. And the Supreme Court, and the president and previous presidents, and the Congress, and the silent consent of the American people have made it that way. Now, I can give my consent to a contract, as Phil has demonstrated, by signing on the dotted line. But I can also give my consent to the president breaking the law, the written law, passed by Congress and signed into law by a preceding president, by remaining silent. Let me explain. When Barack Obama released five al-Qaeda terrorists in exchange for Army deserter Bo Bergdahl, he did not give Congress the 30 days notice required by the law. He broke the law. Now, some might find that to be trivial, but he broke the law. And I'm not the only one in America who says so. The president didn't stretch the law's ambiguity. He didn't use executive discretion. He broke the law, pure and simple. And for that, and a host of other constitutional affronts, he should be impeached without further delay. But he will not be impeached because the Republican-dominated Congress doesn't want to do anything that will possibly generate sympathy for the Democratic Party nominee in next year's presidential election. And impeaching this president, no matter how much he deserves it, would do just that. The argument should be over the president's respect for the Constitution and not who will be the next president. But that's where we find ourselves. The American people, by and large, could care less what their Constitution says and means. Unless they belong to a Tea Party group somewhere, they could care less whether the president abides by his oath of office. And to make it worse, they have no idea what that oath says or means. Ask any American at random if the president has committed unimpeachable offenses. Well, you're likely to get a blank stare, just like you had switched to speaking in Swahili or Pashtun. The American people's salutary neglect, as Edmund Burke put it, of their civic duty as citizens, their silent consent, has created a tangled mess of a government, and I'm not really sure that it can be safely unraveled. Phil has also pointed out that his son insists he never signed the Constitution. Does that mean he consents to the way it is operating today? I should note that copies of the pocket Constitution published by the National Center for Constitutional Studies, copies that I give out in all my classes, show on the front cover a painting of George Washington, then the president of the Constitutional Convention, handing the viewer of the painting a quill pen with which to sign the document. Obviously, no one can literally sign the Constitution today, but you certainly can figuratively. And I wish every American would, quote, sign the document or sign the Constitution, so to speak, and know what they're signing, and then come to realize what has happened to its meaning over the years. Phil also mentioned the administrative state. He didn't define it too deeply when he mentioned that term, and I'm sure that many don't know what he was referring to. The administrative state is what we call the fact that America is not being governed, at least not so much at least, by our elected representatives in Congress. America is being governed today by unelected bureaucrats in countless executive and independent agencies, all of them created by Congress, by the way. And that's the way it is. There's a great article on this issue by Charles Cook in the present National Review magazine entitled, Shall We Have a King? I think you can tell from the title where the article is going. Everybody should read it. The problem here is that Congress has not only unconstitutionally delegated its legislative powers to these agencies, they have also allowed many of them to set up administrative law courts as well. These agencies thus take on executive, legislative, and judicial powers all to themselves. The doctrine of separation of powers, which we'll talk about in greater detail next week, is completely ignored. If you break one of their laws masquerading as rules, or maybe it's rules masquerading as laws, you won't get a trial by jury. Your guilt will be adjudicated by an administrative law judge who works in that agency. No conflict of interest there, of course. Now, Congress prides itself in saying that they set the broad policy in the laws, and they let the agencies then establish the rules that set that policy in motion. In fact, my very own congressman made a similar statement on Tuesday of this week in a conference call. I had chided Congress for not setting rules for the government of the military, as required by the Constitution. Instead, they let the president force gender-confused individuals and women in all combat ratings onto the military. Setting broad policy is not what the Constitution says nor requires of the Congress. You won't find the word policy anywhere in Article 1. The Constitution gives Congress the exclusive authority to make rules for the government of the military, and for them to acquiesce while the president turns the United States military into a social experiment, and purposefully, in my opinion, tries his darndest to render it combat ineffective, it is a dereliction of duty and a violation of their sacred oath, in my humble view. But I digress. There are more than 4,500 federal crimes on the books, thanks to the administrative state, and various authors have suggested that every American breaks at least three federal laws each and every day, without knowing it, of course, because it's physically impossible to actually know the depth and breadth of those laws, of all those federal regulations. Yet we sit silently by, hoping that our local federal prosecutor will choose someone else to pick on. Welcome to the administrative state, brought to you by the consent of the American people. I can just see the commercial now. Let's now take up the first part of Jefferson's statement, that government derives its just powers from our consent. Let's begin by reading the Tenth Amendment. It says, "The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states, respectively, or to the people." This means that the federal government has only powers that we, the people, delegated to it through the written Constitution. Everything else was reserved to the states or is still retained to this day by the people. How do we know what powers were delegated by the people to the United States through their Constitution? Well, we start, in my view, by reading the Declaration of Independence to discover the principles upon which our government was designed. Then we move to a study of the Articles of Confederation period to learn what governmental problems they encountered that had to be solved. That helps us understand their solutions. Then we read Madison's notes of the Constitutional Convention to learn the alternative paths that were considered and rejected as they sought solutions to these problems. Then we read the ratification debates to see what words and phrases meant to those Americans who accepted the document on our behalf. Now, that process I've laid out sounds pretty hard. A lot of people say it's way too hard. How am I going to fit all that into my busy schedule of watching Monday Night Football and Dancing with the Stars? Well, welcome to the administrative state, brought to you by the laziness of the American people. Now, before I'm accused of being a hypocrite here, I will admit that I spent most of my adult life as ignorant of the Constitution as I now accuse others of so being. I had other pursuits, hobbies, and interests. I thought the government could get along fine without me, cruising on autopilot, if you'll allow the aeronautical term. But one day I woke up and smelled the roses, so to speak, and they stunk. I discovered what had happened to Mr. Madison's idea of enumerated powers. The Supreme Court threw that idea out way back in the 1930s and 1940s. And that's why unraveling this mess of a government will be so difficult. We've got 80 to 100 years of legal precedent that has created a government of nearly unlimited powers. Not because the people wished it to be so, but primarily because 9 unelected lawyers thought it should be so. And Congress said, suits us just fine. So that's now what we have with our tacit consent. Dismantling the administrative state will take a long time, if we're lucky enough to survive as a constitutional republic long enough to do so. About half the American people have become dependent on the federal government for their livelihood, many for their basic subsistence. Changing that will take a long, long, long time. But it can be done. As I tell my classes, until there are soldiers in the streets enforcing martial law, there is still a chance of turning things around. If people want it to happen, it will happen. But we have to show the American people that it is absolutely necessary that we do so. Demonstrate that we are on an unsustainable path. The ship of state, in my view, is headed for the proverbial waterfall. We can hear the roar, and we can feel the speed of the river quickening. Will we make it to the shore or go over the falls? The fate of America is in the hands of Americans. Thus endeth the sermon. So, that's all I have to say. Now, Phil or David, do you want to chime in on anything that I've said? I see we don't have any callers waiting in the queue at the moment. So, what is your view of this idea that the administrative state needs to be dismantled? Can it be done?
To that, I'd give a hearty amen. It needs to be done. In fact, what we have is a complete abrogation, as you've laid out in excellent detail, of the very contract that our founders formed with our people, we the people. So your path to say we need to reinvigorate the Constitution starting with individuals is exactly what we do at Institute on the Constitution. By the way, if I could just put in a little ad here, if people would like to take our U.S. Constitution course live online on January 21st for six sessions on Thursday night, 7 o'clock Eastern Time, we'll be online. So if people would like to sign up for that and get the link to be able to do that, go to our website, theamericanview.com, and Michael Peruca and myself will be doing those lectures live. So invite people to do that because, as you're stating, Gary, the history of our country has been lost, and the history of what our Constitution means has been jettisoned. And unless we get the people to rise up and say, we will not tolerate this, we will only put people in office who are going to fulfill their oath of office according to the founders' understanding of the meaning of those words, unless we do that, we cannot undo this administrative state and turn us back to a government of the people, by the people, and for the people.
Well, absolutely. Now, let's look at this idea of power for a moment. Governments derive their just powers from the consent of the government, but the consent of the governed. But what really is power? Let me introduce this topic. There's a trend on college campuses today where students seem to think that power comes from shouting and confrontation, and they have actually been rewarded by having administrators leave their offices and other policies put in place that they demanded. Is that the same thing as power? Is that a power that is the same as the power that government employs? Phil, what do you think? Is that power?
Well, first, I'd reflect on the fact that it's noise. It's not necessarily power. And noise may impress some people. It may impress people in the administration, in the faculties of these universities. But in the long run, I think they'll just get hoarse. And, you know, it may cause people to reflect on the entire higher educational system to the detriment of the people who are now in power in that system as they look at that educational system and say, what kind of bang for the buck are we getting out of this system? It's terribly expensive. We send our children off to this after laboring through a major part of our lives. We expend our resources, and we send them out to get exposed to this kind of nonsense. Maybe there are better ways to educate outside of the formal academic community.
That
so my
like
sense
a,
for this is that in the long run, that those people who feel that noise will determine justice are very much misled, and they're going over that waterfall that you were talking about, Gary.
Well, I think there's a topic for a future show. I think you've alluded to what is a better way of educating than our present system, and you certainly have a view of that from the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute. I see we have a caller on the line, a Faith from Pottstown, Pennsylvania. So let's let Faith ask her question or comment. Faith, how are you doing this morning?
I'm fine, thanks. Good morning.
Good morning.
My question is, how important, let me rephrase it. I've been doing a little study on clandestine groups, societies. There are several, go down the alphabet, and I've noticed that if it's true, there are certain people, even in of faith, and I mean true faith, are involved in secret societies or some form of them. Is that alarming to you?
Well, it's certainly alarming to me, and I think you're probably referring to things like the Trilateral Commission and the Council on Foreign Relations.
I am.
We all wonder what is the true extent of their influence. And I don't think anyone knows to really be able to answer that question objectively, but it is troubling because we can see the effects that something is going on behind the scenes, that there is definitely influence being exerted behind the scenes that doesn't seem to jive with the with what the American people would want or the way they would express it if they were given a chance to vote on a certain issue. And so, I can't answer your question really completely because I don't know what the true influence of these groups are, but I'm pretty sure they exist, and I'm pretty sure they are able to influence the political process in ways that we really can't fathom right now. And that doesn't even speak to the issue of the corporate interests, the lobbyists who descend on Washington in the thousands, who then write these laws on behalf of the congressmen and put into place in those laws the little niches that give them favoritism in how the law is expressed. Well, Faith, I don't know whether that answers your question, but I do want to thank you for calling in because as a first-time caller, you are eligible for a pocket constitution. So before you leave the call, make sure that you give your mailing address to the folks at the station, or maybe you'll have to call back to do that. We'll get you a pocket constitution in the mail. Do you think that helped your understanding of the question at all? Oh, okay. Well,
I'd like to add one illustration of that. I don't know if people remember when Bush and Kerry were running for president. Both of them, it turns out, members of a secret society from Yale University called Skull and Bones.
Yeah.
And both of them were asked on air, on TV, at different times, you know, what was it about Skull and Bones or whatever? And both of them replied in a very similar fashion, because you see the two video clips right next to each other. Both of them kind of smiled in a little strange smile and said, well, I can't tell you about it. It's a secret. It's like, well, wait a minute. We have a choice between Skull and Bones 1 and Skull and Bones 2. Is there any real difference between the two of these? And what is that secret society all about? It is a concern, and that's why we need to look into everybody we vote for. And most of all, we need to ask them the pointed questions that our Constitution raises as to what they believe, and then we need to make an evaluation of their character to determine whether they are people that you can trust to honor the oath that they have taken. You know, the current resident there in the White House is obviously one who has no problem lying with almost every statement he makes, and I'm saddened that the American people elected him a second time, knowing in his first 4 years, having proved himself to be a consummate liar, the character of the person we're electing is critically important.
Well, absolutely. And, Phil, what would you say about this idea of clandestine or secret societies and their influence on government and politics in America? Do you think it's a real issue that bears examination, or is it just something that continues to find root in the in emails that make the rounds around the circuit?
Well, I'd like to address an aspect of this that often comes up, and it's used as a way of kind of getting us off track on this issue, and that is how are these issues raised? Are they raised as conspiracies? And of course, as soon as anybody mentions the conspiracy word, they're the target of mockery. I think we should understand that a conspiracy is by definition limited to a small group, that it's an illegal activity and it's bound to secrecy. And when you look at something like the Trilateral Commission and similar Skull and Bones and all the rest of that, there are just too many people involved in it to call it a conspiracy. I mean, it has conspiratorial kinds of influences, if you will. But there's a much larger thing here that is a force, and we have to become very sensitive to that, and that is the issue of culture. Basically, what we have created over time is culture, And culture is adopted by a larger group. It's a set of values that get passed on from generation to generation. And I think it's culture that we have to look at and ask ourselves, isn't that the issue? And what are the tools that we use to take down the culture when the culture is evil? If I could just make a final comment about the classic example here, I think, that relates to this idea of the consent of the government, of the governed, is the Nazi era, where, this was the issue. In retrospect, we looked back at it and we said, there was consent by silence of the of the German people. And that's not the German people today. That's the German people who were involved in this. But nonetheless, we should realize that we are not helpless in the face of an oppressive government here. Look at what those people went through, but then look at the outstanding exceptions to that. Die Weiße Rose, the White Rose, challenged that idea that the government was legitimate. That became an essential part of the recovery process for the German people, because they understood that there were individuals who were willing to stand up to the herd.
Well, definitely the culture is changing. As I alluded to there, talking about the college campuses, David and you and I can probably remember going to college ourselves, and we had a different culture. There was a different culture in college campuses. Yes, there were protests, but they were not confrontational as much as they are today. They were not in your face. They were not so demanding as they are today. So I think the culture on college campuses is changing, and not for the better.
I would agree with that.
Well, anything to add, David?
Well, we need to create educational institutions, like you say. We ought to have a discussion about that down the road, but educational institutions that truly allow students to wrestle with the ideas that our founders clearly understood and wrestled with. Most of them, George Washington as being the exception, were graduates of the colleges of that day, and those colleges mostly were designed to train people for ministry. James Madison was actually training for the pastorate at what's now called Princeton University, and spent a year of graduate study studying the Bible, studying Hebrew, and studying Greek, and studying scriptures in the original languages. So there's a whole lot of what education was designed to accomplish.
We will definitely have to devote a show to that, because I think people will be really interested to find out what colleges were in this country at one time. James Madison wrote in Federalist 48 that an elective despotism was not the government we fought for, but one in which the powers of government should be so divided and balanced among the several bodies of magistracy as that no one could transcend their legal limits without being effectively checked and restrained by the others. That's what they tried to give us. That's not what we have today. We are edging ever closer to an elective despotism. So that's all the time we have today. We recommend you download the podcast of this show and send it to your congressman, see what he says. Otherwise, join us next week for another segment of We the People, the Constitution Matters. Bring somebody new with you. We'll see you next week.
Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFIL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.